Well, bureaucrats say a man is chewing the cud. Just to post-serve, made of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood, just to feed the machine. If you drive your car, they will make you scream. 16 runs, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. Robin St. Peter, the Bay City Hall. I owe my gold to the Calpagathol. I got up in the morning when the sun didn't shine. I got in my Chevy Coupe to Avenue 9. After 16 runs, it was taking its toll. And the pipe plus chime, well, bless my soul. 16 runs, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. From Robin St. Peter to Bay City Hall. I owe my gold to the Calpagathol. I got up one morning, it was drizzling rain. Fighting and trouble, my middle name. A pimp in a report shrieks greenhouse gas. Can't no high tone mare make me take a bus pass. 16 runs, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. I'm Robin St. Peter, Bay City Hall. I owe my gold to the Calpagathol. Well, if you see the enforcer, better quicken your stride. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men cried. One fist of iron, the other a steel. If the right don't get you, then the left one will. 16 runs, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. From Robin St. Peter to Bay City Hall. I owe my gold to the
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Charles Lewis interviewed by David Swanson, and he talks about his book, 935 Lies. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in Sacramento, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
The idea of reading a story or running something by them is common. I mean, because they're very, very concerned that they will do something that kills people and then have egg on their face. But the so-called Abu Ghraib prison abuse issue back in 2004, I don't know if you recall this, but
sure.
Seymour Hersh and CBS broke that story, but CBS sat on the story for 2 weeks because Richard Myers, the then chief of staff to the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon, asked CBS not to broadcast because it would endanger soldiers' lives. And he met with them in New York, and they agreed to sit on it for 2 weeks. And finally, the network was getting very frustrated and impatient. And meanwhile, they knew Cy Hersh was going to break it and could care less about this. And of course, he worked for the New Yorker as a freelance writer, but and I'm sure there were some conversations, but no one ever called Cy Hersh because they know what he would have done.
Yeah.
And in fact, he then, when they knew he was going to break it, they said, the hell with this, and they went on the air finally. And of course, it was an incredibly important story. And by the way, no one died because of that story. So,
and he's had to start going. He's had to start going to British media now. I mean, he can't get his stories published
yeah.
in the United States at all.
The London Review of Books, I think, or something like
yeah.
that. He is. Now, it's very unfortunate. I know Cy pretty well. I've known him for decades, and it's a sorry commentary when a journalist of his stature and caliber can't find a place to publish. But that is, in a way, a snapshot of what we're describing, where things are today.
Yeah. Speaking of documents, it was when we had a document that was called the Downing Street Minutes that that we made a real push for accountability for Bush's lies and Cheney's lies and the 935 that give the title to your book, which was a great production of yours, the list of 935 lies. But yet you say you're not sure if they knew they were lying, and that just floors me. I mean, here's a guy who chatted with Tony Blair. Let's paint a U.S. plane with U.N. colors and fly it low and see if they'll shoot at it. And then walked out to the podium and said, "We're trying to avoid a war. It will be our last resort." And how is it possible to imagine that these guys didn't know they were lying?
Well, no. I mean, I have eventually, gradually. I try to give people the benefit of the doubt. I know that sounds quaint, but back then, you know, no one has actually interviewed any of the eight people we tracked with their false statements that added up to 935 lies from 9/11 to 2 years after 9/11. And so no one has actually done a face-to-face interview on camera or off camera or any kind of recorded interview with anyone, with any of those eight people. And all their memoirs, they said they had bad intelligence, which, of course, is obscene, you know, a ridiculous thing to say. But the fact of the matter is there is a sentiment going back to, like, Aristotle that, you know, sometimes more dangerous than a lie is when people actually believe what they're saying. They've convinced themselves it's in the national interest, and they believe it's good for America, and they actually come to believe things that are not true. What I'm getting at is, if I don't have a chance to talk to them, you know, I started out with things, the book about truth in general, and then finally the publisher said, "Well, you've got this great thing you did, the Iraq War Card. This thing should be about 935 lies." And I had been very cautious in using the L word because I knew I would never get access to the White House. They hated me for some other things we had done. We posted all the Iraq and Afghanistan war contracts, among other things, that they hated. But there's other things, too, when I ran the Center for Public Integrity. And I just knew that was not going to happen. So that was my way of standing back and having some degree, or at least attempting a measured judgment of calling it false and erroneous statements when we first published what we called Iraq the War Card back in 08 on the five-year anniversary. Mm-hmm. Over time since then, over the ensuing 5 to 6 years, I came to generally harden my position and decide they definitely were lying. But I was really trying to be cautious about that, because people do make a lot of accusations these days about everyone all the time, 24/7, a lot of split-screen blather on cable and that. I'm not one of those people. I'm generally a cautious cat who reads documents.
So I want, before we run out of time, to sure. To question a hero rather than a goat. Edward R. Murrow comes off mm-hmm. as a hero in most tellings, and I think very rightly so, and very much so in your book, which is wonderful in telling his story of standing up to the pressure from Congress and the attacks and the red baiting and the McCarthyism, and yet you bring up in your story of how great he was the fact that he met with FDR hours after Pearl Harbor, reportedly he spoke to his wife and he spoke to colleagues, you know, that night and in the years that followed about how FDR had given him the biggest story in the history of his life and it could put his kid through college, but he wasn't sure if it was his duty to report it or to stay silent. And I would have thought it was a reporter's duty to report it, to tell the people.
It's a great question. I mean, I know what you're getting at there. It is a problem, you know, in that, but that's basically epitomizes the problem with access journalism. The fact is, Murrow had become a celebrity, a huge celebrity, a global celebrity, but especially in this country. You know, his ship is met at the shores when he comes back in 41 after the Blitzkrieg and everything, and everyone wants to see him, and a big fancy dinner at the Waldorf Astoria. It's nationally broadcast, and he's on a speaking tour nationwide. And there was a social call type event where he and his wife were going to have dinner with Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. And then what happens is, it happens to be the day that the U.S. is attacked in Pearl Harbor by the Japanese, and the public is only just beginning to imagine what has occurred. and not entirely knowing it, and he has not yet spoken to Congress the next day, I guess. And so this is where social and journalistic duty conflict, which is really what we're discussing. And it also goes back to the earlier conversations about phone calls and hobnobbing and have developing sources, including sometimes cabinet secretaries and high officials. You end up become a captive. It's like the moth and the flame. At some point, we know what happens to the moth. It's a problem. And I think, you know, it had to be a terrible dilemma for him. But I also talk about how the U.S. and the British, in the form of Churchill himself, wanted Moreau to work for the government because he was so effective in what he was doing about the cause of the war for both countries at that moment. And as Nicholas Lemon, who at the time he wrote it was the dean of the Columbia Journalism School, he wrote in the New Yorker, is at that particular moment, there was a synchronicity. The stars were properly aligned between what Moreau was reporting and what was in the U.S. and British interest, and he was the darling of officialdom. And in that context, yes, he definitely didn't know what to do about it. Was that a social thing? Was it a professional? He was not interviewing Roosevelt. They were having a sandwich after midnight.
Yes, but if Roosevelt told him, he knew this attack was coming, that they were provoking Japan for months and so forth, and he said, I'll keep quiet about that because of my national interest rather than my journalistic interest.
Yeah, no, I have a problem with that, obviously, but so I'm not defending Moreau. The guy was he was human, and he had blind spots, and that's just clearly not what we know him for, and it's a huge issue, and I understand what you're raising there, and I share the concern about it. But it's almost every major journalistic figure that I've encountered has some sort of close proximity weakness or moment when they had to occasionally not report what they knew. I mean, it's unfortunate. I'm not defending it, but I have seen it, and it's not unique to Edward R. Moreau. Let's put it that way.
Absolutely not. And there are wonderful stories over the decades about these issues and where there is hope, actually, to turn things around in U.S. and world journalism. The book is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. We've been speaking with Charles Lewis, who founded the Center for Public Integrity, and he is a professor at American University. Charles Lewis, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Now, I am with the TSA, and we know as you travel, you have your choice of invasive security measures. So I'm here tonight to give you a hands-on demonstration. Now, although we do have a full-body scanning machine known as the ISL-ISF, which stands for I See London, I See France, we know many of you prefer the full-body pat-down, which I highly recommend. Now, during this random procedure, you are randomly chosen to... You have been randomly chosen for a full-body pat-down. I'm sorry, that water is much too dangerous. We can't have that here. Every time I see a pretty girl in line, I just start to hope it. She will choose a pat-down rather than the x-ray so I can start her open. Since the TSA said it's okay to be fondled by some slob, we've been flooded with complaints as well as applications for this job. So put your cans in the hands of the man that steals your water. Let the hunk give the junk in your trunk a little squeeze. Well, now you can start to do your part, so raise your hands and please. I'll put your cans in the hands of the man with the GED.
My mama taught me what to do with guys like you before I was 7. She said try 40 guys who aren't fit to work at 7-Eleven.
Now when you're in line, your body's mine, the backside can hide a gun.
If you're groped by a dope, then you know the terrorists have won.
I demand that you stand where my handbook says you ought to. I demand that you stand.
Just do what you must do.
Says on your ID, your name is Lee.
But once my name was Stu, you've been putting your hand on the gland of a man. So the joke's on you.
catastrophe. More than 6 million refugees, it could be you and your family, forced from your home and your history.
We are the people, and this is our time. Stand up, sing out for Palestine.
No matter your faith or community, this is a crime against humanity. Gaza turned into a prison camp. Apartheid war divides the West Bank.
We are the people, and this is our time. Stand up, sing out for Palestine.
We'll break down the wall. Freedom for Palestine. Demand justice for all. Freedom for Palestine.
Enough illegal occupation. Violence and racial segregation. All religious communities unite.
Freedom is a human right.
We are the people, and this is our time. Stand up, sing out for Palestine.
We'll break down the wall. Freedom for Palestine. Demand justice for all. Freedom for Palestine.
You're deadlocked by doctrine, locked like a box you're locked in. Soon bones are dropped in, and the pain is locked in. Shame on this brave new world you're lost in. And the lies is costing like a toxin, a penetration of hate. Generations later, still boxed in. Children dead because we're led by the bigoted. Small graves filled instead, and I'm sick of it.
We are the people, and this is our time.
Have you been injured in a car accident? Are you entitled to compensation because of someone's negligence? If that is the case, of course you can find a lawyer. But what if you have a claim that is so crazy no lawyer will touch it? At the law office of alleged terrorist Zacharias Moussaoui, we are ready to handle your litigation needs. Mr. Moussaoui is currently acting as his own attorney. So you know he specializes in those hard-to-win cases.
I will not let my virulent loathing of the United States, my hatred of your government, or my contempt for your legal system stand in the way of getting you the best possible settlement.
Has spilled coffee made you sterile? Has the FBI controlled your mind by sprinkling syphilis on your cornflakes? Have Israeli Special Forces, Universal Pictures, and Captain Stubing from the Love Boat conspired to rob you of your livelihood by having Tom Cruise get all the money, fame, and women that are rightfully yours? Well, just sit back and watch as Counselor Moussaoui practices his unique brand of legal gymnastics.
I have yet to win a case, which is not surprising in a secular, godless society, which allows its devil-worshipping judges to feast upon the bloated carrion of justice.
But I have a good feeling about your case.
Remember, if you have a phone, you have a stark, raving lunatic
who hates our country but loves our constitutional protections.
It has been said that the man who represents himself has a fool for a client.
Put that fool to work for you.
And they will also refund a portion of your pretrial expenses if for any reason you are not satisfied.
Or if I'm executed.
The Law Office of Zacharias Moussaoui.
Call now and receive a free jihad.
It's not just his prices that are insane.
Red wine was ever voiced up. The way they turned the for war.
Now for something completely different.